In the parking lot, I got a call that I would be testing for my first film on the Paramount lot in a week. They thought I'd potentially been Wayans Brothers funny. The universe is speaking to us all the time. It was the biggest professional risk I'd taken up until that moment, and none of the worst-case scenarios came to pass. In fact, it was just the opposite, and more important than any of that was the fact that I'd taken enough ownership over my own path to give myself the permission to fail spectacularly. In the end, I lost the role to another actor who tested. I think his name was Damon Wayans Jr. or something like that. Damon is a nephew in the family lineage. It's all good. Damon is damn funny and has never rested on his laurels. He works hard and he's made a ton happen for himself over the years. I'm a fan. But when it was all said and done, mine was the only evaluation that mattered. I administered the test. I'd be the only one who knew if I passed or if I failed with flying colors. I hope you'll give yourself permission to do the same as soon as possible. Deeper creative freedom waits for you on the other side of your fear. Chapter 6, The Turnaround. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. James Baldwin. I've never placed a lot of credence in astrology, but when I was first told about the phenomenon known as the Saturn return, I had trouble shaking the warning I was given. A friend who had been through a challenging time at about 29 years old said that the orbiting of Saturn around the sun and its return to where it was at the time of his birth had brought on major changes and thrown everything about his life into question. It was a time of change and big choices, he said, about what we really want to make of our lives for the next 30 years. He got my attention. The truth is that change was already in the wind, and I knew the time had come to either dream a bigger dream or get busy creating a new reality. Not all the changes that had taken place had to do with conscious decisions on my part. One of them, meeting Nicolette Clo Robinson when I was 27 years old, happened by a grander design than my own. My mentor, Billy Porter, was coming to L.A. to direct a short run of Once on This Island, a magical love story for a small but reputable theater company in town. "What are you doing?" Billy screamed at me over the phone. I knew the tone and the tenor of the man well by then. What should I be doing? Billy was always looking to share opportunities, so whenever he had a project on the burner, he'd look for ways to include me. If something was on my calendar, I'd make it disappear. "I'm coming to town to direct Island. I need you to assist me. When do we start?" There were 2 weeks of pre-production. I got Billy coffee. I took notes for him. I made demos of the new musical arrangements he'd created. Being around Billy was always worthwhile, always a good hang. He taught and led by example, and I could count on him to push me creatively 100% of the time. When auditions began, my role shifted to that of a reader. That meant I became the scene partner for every actor who auditioned. You can learn a lot sitting on the other side of the table all day in an audition room. On our second day of seeing people, a young woman reading for the role of T-Moon, the central character in the musical, caught everyone's attention. Lithe and lit up from the inside, a then 19-year-old Nicolette Clo Robinson walked into the room, and anyone with a pulse took notice. She was in her junior year at UCLA in the theater department, and I thought she was a major discovery. Nicolette's pure heart rests right on her sleeve. You only have to know her for a few seconds before you find yourself caring about what happens to her. That quality felt like an essential characteristic for our central character, if you ask me, but I wasn't in charge. Nick didn't get the role, but I distinctly recall thinking, the business is so small, I'm sure I'll run into that girl again. A few weeks later, we were almost done with rehearsals and we were just about to move from the rehearsal room into the theater when a cast member's husband's health took a turn for the worse. She had to drop out and tend to her family immediately. There was something like 3 days left before the production had to be ready to be in front of paying customers. Billy had to think fast. He shifted some things internally and brought the talented UCLA student in to play a different role from the one she had auditioned for. Since I was Billy's assistant on the project, it fell to me to make sure Nicolette was up to speed and comfortable. Easiest job I ever had. Nicolette was so gifted and learned at lightning speed. Her disposition was breezy, Los Angeles sunny, and the space around her was calm and focused. There was nothing not to love. Nick and I would meet backstage during traffic patterns and slow dance before our next cue. I'd wait in the wings for her to finish her big moment in Act Two, just to bear witness to her growth from show to show and marvel at her sparkle in the light. A peck on the cheek had become a kiss on the lips by the closing weekend of Island. A week after parting at the theater, we made plans to hang out, and we haven't stopped since. She is the best friend I've ever had, and the kindest and most generous person I've ever known. A pro tip on love, if you'll allow me. When choosing a partner, choose someone better than you. You'll feel lucky to be building alongside someone you respect, and it'll keep you striving to be the best version of yourself, always. You may not have met the person yet, but they're out there. Love is a risk like any other. Have faith. Let go of the past narrative of near misses and err on the side of you never know. My longest and most meaningful relationship, another gift for which I have Billy Porter to thank. His hand wasn't directly responsible for bringing us together, but he set the stage. These are people you keep close. Over the years, I've made it a habit to grab and hold on to mentors. Ever since Mrs. Turner, I've always found them easy to identify. Preferably, you want them close in proximity. FaceTime with your mentor will be important in your development. You need someone who is willing enough to share with you. The best mentors will open and read from the private pages of their lives so that you may learn from their mistakes. Sure, you can glean valuable info from their success, but their failures, if they're generous enough to share them, can save you years of heartache and help you make informed decisions when you find yourself at a crossroads, in my experience. When you meet someone you respect and admire, do your best to hang on to them. Be in touch. Listen well and apply the lessons they help you discover when you see fit. Be prepared for gaps along the way. There are times you may find yourself without a mentor or someone close who has perhaps trod a similar path. These are the times when you'll stand in the gap for yourself. You'll show up for yourself and collect the memories from your triumphs and spectacular failures to share with a young person who will look to you as a mentor soon enough. You may find that a mentor who's achieved goals similar to your own doesn't quite exist in the way you've imagined. All that means is, lace up. You're the person. You will blaze the trail and become the mentor you've always dreamed of. I sat in front of my mentor in 2011, shortly before my 30th birthday, and the future felt gravely uncertain. I was depressed and in real need of advice from somebody who could help me see my way out of a painful spot. After weeks of weighing my options, I had all but made up my mind to end my acting career in favor of something, anything, more stable. I looked to Stuart K. Robinson to guide me toward the stability I craved. When I pulled into the driveway of his house a few years prior to this moment, I knew there was a great deal I could learn from Stuart, but I hadn't predicted that he would become someone whose counsel I would seek regularly in years to come. At the time, I had been on a few dates with his daughter, Nicolette, and the dinner that night had been carefully planned for me to meet the whole family and hopefully pass muster. Meeting all the Robinsons brought out a sense of home and family for me that has only deepened since. And meeting Stuart opened my eyes to new possibilities for my own path. Stuart managed to put two kids through college and buy a home and a vacation home and take his wife out to dinner every now and then. And he did it all somehow without ever becoming a household name. Obviously, I was familiar with the African-American actors and entertainers in Hollywood who achieved superstar status against the odds. Who wasn't? Will Smith, Samuel L. Jackson, Whoopi Goldberg. Some you know by first names alone. Denzel, Oprah. These superstars have names you've heard often and bodies of work you know extremely well. You wouldn't really hear about the blue-collar success of someone like Stuart outside of his large but mainly local sphere of influence. But Stuart had made it, in my eyes. He started out as an actor and then made the move to other areas of the business. He found success in casting, teaching, public speaking, and even as the COO of a major commercial agency in Los Angeles. He built a life for himself and his family in this industry and found a way to successfully sustain it for 40 years. Yeah, I knew Stu could teach me a lot. We'd come to share quite a bit over the years, but his finest hour as a mentor and friend came at that very moment in 2011 when I needed it most. Some of us have a sense that we have to figure out everything on our own. We mistakenly think that being in need of help or advice is a sign of weakness. Give your friends and mentors the gift of showing up for you. Can you identify the 3 to 5 people who love you most? They want to help you. They want you to win. Reach out. The first step out of any depression or stagnation is asking for help. One vulnerable conversation with Stuart, and I was never the same. The uncertainty and feelings of being stuck were different from what I'd felt before. After the major breakthrough and other lessons of growth in my 20s, I was no longer plagued by the lack of inspiration in my work. I'd seen a change in myself in front of the camera. I was taking more risks, and the risks saw my booking rate increase. I was booking relatively big jobs and making fans at the networks. If the phone was ringing, usually it meant I was working, and that was good enough for me. What I couldn't figure out, what I couldn't stand anymore, was all the time when the phone wasn't ringing. The final straw had come in connection to a pilot I'd recently done. It's true I had done pilots before, but there was something different about this one. I had fought for the role and won it after 7 or 8 auditions. The show was interesting and sexy, with a winning cast and producing team attached. I had my hopes set on a series pickup and a 6-season run. Short of that, I was sure that being a part of such a high-profile project would get the phone ringing, even if we weren't picked up. I was wrong. After it was all over and the pilot didn't become a series, I found nothing had changed. The needle hadn't moved at all. I was in exactly the same spot. The lack of control was enough for me to want to throw in the towel and focus on something, anything, more secure. The fact that I was a part of the small percentage of union card holders in Los Angeles to find themselves employed in the entertainment business meant that I was achieving success. But when even success starts to feel like failure, it's time to make some changes. Stuart had found tremendous success in other areas of the business. The FaceTime I'd requested was not to get Stuart to tell me how I could make it as an actor. I was done with that. I wanted the opposite of the life I'd been living. Stu, having heard me out, nodded in silence. He then took a long sip of his water, taking extra care with his word choice. I'm sure he could see and feel that I was pretty fragile and wound up. The truth is that I was in a bit of a state. Stu confirmed and reassured. He said, of course I had the freedom to quit and try something new with my life. He said that we could talk about other possibilities if that's what I wanted to do. And then he spoke the words that would change everything. But I'd love to see you try before you quit. His words felt like a punch in the gut. A well-intentioned punch, but a punch in the gut just the same. He wanted to see me try. What did he think I did in these audition rooms? How did he think I'd manage to gain any ground in the 9 years I'd been in L.A.? Still, I listened. You don't think I try? I asked in earnest. Stu drove the point home. I think you do extraordinarily well when you're called upon. I think you show up and you're confident because of your preparation. He paused and asked the million-dollar question. But what did you do on your own behalf today? Did you do anything other than wait? Did you call anyone? Did you send an email? You have great relationships with people who know your worth. Do they even know you're out of work? Whoa. The questions embarrassed me because I knew exactly what he was driving at. I wasn't doing nearly enough to help myself. It was a total blind spot. I'd been sitting on my hands. I could feel the clouds parting as my mentor went on. You could get a band together and go to all the local coffee shops. They'd love to have live music. You haven't been singing at all. He reminded me that I had never explored commercials or voiceover work. I've invited you to take my class for the last year. You could start there. I was a bit ashamed not to have thought of any of this sooner. I almost couldn't wait for our session to be over so that I could get to work for real. Stuart taught a commercial class in town that was renowned. It was probably only because he was Nicolette's old man that I had ignored it for so long. I enrolled in the beginner's class and started the following week. My class was primarily made up of novices and newcomers. You could tell sometimes by the wardrobe or the drawl. Mostly you could tell from the sunny dispositions. These people were excited. They were stoked to be getting their commercial careers underway and to be learning about the secrets to success from the man they'd heard so much about. I was less sunny, of course. Pros aren't sunny. My heart and ego were still pretty banged up and bruised, but I thought I was hiding it well. The first lesson came early. Stuart told us we were auditioning for a toothpaste commercial. He sent us to the front of the room in groups of four and went down the line with a camera as he asked innocuous, casual questions while filming each response. What's your name? How tall are you? What's the last great movie you saw? What's your favorite dessert? Sometimes there was a follow-up question, sometimes there wasn't. The whole thing took maybe 45 seconds a person. He made his way through everyone in the class in 20 minutes or so. I'd been clever and charming, I thought. Simple enough. I didn't know what the test was exactly, but I thought I did all right. As far as I could see, there was varying success from the class on our first assignment. Some of the newest and most inexperienced members of the class couldn't think of an answer to Stu's question at all. They'd smile bashfully and search for words. Some would answer confidently and go for a joke to ease tension. I watched each one and tried to see it through Stu's eyes. I had no idea what he'd be looking for, but I tried to guess. Pros are easy to spot, I thought. All right, so, Stu began when everyone in the class had been recorded. There are times in a casting office when we're extremely busy and doing other things while the audition tapes play silently in the background. We're looking for a spark, a transmittance of warmth and feeling even in silence. He muted the sound. We watched playback of the toothpaste exercise we'd just done in silence. What message are you sending out even before you open your mouth? What soundless story is your body telling when you enter a room? The biggest surprise? It was astonishing. to see just how fresh and inviting the newcomers were. A bashful and honest smile was worth 1,000 canned, safe responses any day. With the sound off especially, the novices were killing it. Then it gets to my 45 seconds on the tape, and I could see so clearly the difference between the newcomers and me, and it wasn't the fact that I was a pro. The difference that I could see was as plain as day. There was a film of corrosion and jadedness over me that had to be stripped immediately. I'd misjudged the newcomers. It was me who had much to learn. Years of heartbreak and rejection had made me guarded. I was tight and tense, and it wasn't being hidden well at all. You would call that sunny newcomer back 10 times out of 10 before you'd want to see the jaded guy again. When I broke it down for myself later that night, I came up with a plan of action. I made a commitment to myself to come rushing forward in the rooms I was invited into. No hanging back. No waiting to find out if it was safe before bringing what I had to the table. I am bringing it regardless. Moving forward, I would risk the rejection and take more responsibility for the energy I was carrying with me into rooms. I would be as fresh and as free as the newcomer. The lesson of the Saturn return was a reminder that each of us have a choice. Do we let the past dictate our future, or do we come rushing forward with the best we have to offer? A week after my very first class with Stuart, I booked 2 national commercials and a great part on the Don Cheadle vehicle for Showtime called House of Lies. After the 2nd and 3rd classes, it was a part on Supernatural. A week after that, I had to leave Stuart's class completely because I was on a plane to New York as an added cast member on a new series for NBC, Smash. For the rest of my life, I will credit Stuart K. Robinson for getting me off my couch. I made a commitment to myself that I would never again sit in inaction, waiting for the phone to ring. I was ignoring at least half of my responsibility as a businessman. What are you ignoring today? What did you do to help yourself today? Who did you call? What did you read? Did you take one step towards something that makes you come alive today? If you're willing to take one humble and meaningful step toward making a dream come true, the universe will take 2. You will be aided. You will get the help you desire and desperately need. Take the step. You'll win or you'll learn. Chapter 7. Hamilton, Act 1, Our Town. An artist spends their whole life trying to get back to the place where their heart was first opened up. Some genius. 20 seconds. 8 bars. That's how long it took in July of 2013 to feel the irrepressible tug of history in the making. The lights had barely gone down on the first ever staged reading of the Hamilton mixtape at a festival of new works on the Vassar College campus in Poughkeepsie, New York. The reading started, and in a blink, I was transported right back to that record store in Philadelphia where I first heard the entire Rent cast album standing on my feet at a listening station. That place where my heart had first been opened up. I knew right then that I had been waiting for my whole artistic life to feel that feeling once more. Nicolette was on the campus for the summer, working on a piece she loved. I visited often to watch my favorite performer in action. I'd catch other new shows and performance whenever I could. On the festival schedule, there were 2 performances listed for the Hamilton mixtape at the 100-seat Powerhouse Theater. Both sold out almost immediately. This new work was from the creative team behind In the Heights, after all. As its composer and lead performer, Lin-Manuel Miranda had won Tony and Grammy Awards for his work in the semi-autobiographical musical Celebration of the Manhattan neighborhood where he had come of age. In the Heights had closed a couple of years earlier. The industry eagerly awaited the sophomore outing from the talented young man and his cabinet of collaborators. The pre-excitement meant that even in the development stage, scoring a ticket to see the new work was nearly impossible. Not even a tweet to Lin could get me in. I'd made friends with a few ushers during my frequent trips to see Nick. My powerful friends with flashlights saw to it that when the lights went down at the start of the reading, I was able to grab an empty seat in the very last row of the tiny theater. The mixtape included only Act One at the time. Act Two was still very much a work in progress. But the first 20 seconds gave us a glimpse into something extraordinary. It was multi-layered brilliance, made all the more powerful and resonant because of the well-chosen multi-ethnic cast of performers giving their hearts to the material. Lin's score was so bold and fresh and confident. For me, hearing it for the first time is what falling in love feels like. I had met Lin only briefly before. Our paths had crossed a handful of times at social events or at the theater. I knew that the Hamilton mixtape was not a fully realized show yet, but what they had already was so special. What they showed us that afternoon at Vassar was once-in-a-lifetime special. By the end of the Hamilton mixtape, I was emotional for all kinds of reasons, some of which I can barely explain. I know now that part of my reaction surrounded lingering questions I had about translation and the things that get lost along the way when going from one language to another. Less than a year prior to taking my seat in the back of the small theater at Vassar, 100-year-old text had illuminated a cultural blind spot for me. I'd been wrestling with existential questions it presented for months, and though I wouldn't have been able to explain how or why, in that moment, the Hamilton mixtape felt like the answer. For actors of color, a large determining factor of our success in the business is closely related to how good we are at translation. Flashback to the 100-year-old text. I was cast in a benefit reading of Thornton Wilder's lasting and iconic Our Town for the Actors Fund in New York. The one-night-only event would feature the talents of B.D. Wong, Essipaitha Merkerson, Celia Keenan Bolger, and others whom I had long respected and admired. These types of nights can be a lot of fun, but preparation is key. They're well attended by industry insiders. The evenings are relatively low stakes, but very high pressure. You want to feel good about how you did because there are no do-overs. A couple of days before the first rehearsal, while preparing to play George, the young male lead of the piece, I found myself smack dab in the middle of a mild identity crisis when asking myself the question, but who am I really? You see, Thornton Wilder's beautifully wrought Our Town was never intended to be my town. By that I mean, even though Our Town tells the story of the fictional Grover's Corners, New Hampshire, a stand-in for a kind of every town USA, when looking at context clues from almost every major production of the seminal work, there don't appear to be any people of color drawn in Wilder's quintessential American town. Fine. Our Town, which follows the lives of George Gibbs and Emily Webb and those of their families and some of the town's other residents, did have universal dimensions, to be sure. The play is set in 1901 and takes place over a period of 12 years. Narrated by an omniscient stage manager, the script takes us through different life stages that run the gamut from the mundane to the peaks of romance and marriage and the lows of death and loss. At the time of its debut, Our town, staged with no scenery and no curtain, was considered to be a radical departure from traditional theater. After a thorough read of the play, it was time to begin the process of finding honest, empathetic pathways to a credible portrayal of George. For me, it always begins with as strong a vision as I can conjure of myself inhabiting the world of the play. But this time, try as I might, I couldn't get a clear vision. I couldn't apply much of my American experience to Thornton Wilder's New England town. In my deep dive, I had serious doubts about whether Mr. Wilder wrote his play with an eye toward the color-conscious casting of his seminal work at some distant point in the future. Wilder wrote the truth as he imagined it. He wrote the truth about a small town of white strivers at the turn of the century. It is through his detail and specificity that he is able to tap into powerful and universal truths about the human experience. Obviously, a play about the specific and unique concerns of a town full of black people at that same point in American history would have an entirely different language and tone. For context, 1901 saw the first publication of Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery, about his life's journey from child slave to nationally renowned orator, philosopher, educator, and author. Just 5 years earlier, in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson cemented legal segregation of the races, with a landmark decision handed down from the highest court in the land. It was a line drawn in the sand and on our buses, train cars, restrooms, diners. It set the stage for the future American horror stories of the Jim Crow South. In 1905, W.E.B. Du Bois founded the Niagara Movement, a civil rights organization that preceded the NAACP, whose prescient ethos called for an end to racial segregation and disenfranchisement. All around the United States, there were riots rooted in the protest against racism and its ugliness. Now, of course, the mundane existed for black people in 1901, too. We cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner as well. We went shopping, dancing. Black children played hopscotch and football in the street, too. But the more I read and tried to imagine, the more it felt like my casting and Mr. Wilder's text were at odds. It was the trickiest translation job I'd ever been given, and I wasn't sure it was going to work at all. Am I a black George in Thornton Wilder's Our Town? Am I to investigate the way these scenes would play differently as Black George? Won't my race impact the power dynamics in the play or dramatically alter the temperature in some of these scenes? Or am I meant to ignore all this? Am I a white person for the evening? Am I, instead of Black George, Black George in whiteface? My imagination had posed the question, who am I really? Integrity demanded that I hunt down the answer. Logical solutions eluded me. I had no clue how I was going to translate Mr. Wilder's text into anything that came close to a truthful rendering on stage. In the midst of something of a downward spiral, I paused, and after some deep breaths, the voice of my wiser self took over. This is an experiment, and no one has the answers. You have been invited into the room to search for the answers alongside your collaborators. You're afraid. Guess what? So is everybody else. This experiment will work, or it won't work, but you've been invited into the room to explore. The exploration is the mission. You have the permission to fail. I had to remind myself of it then. I have to remind myself of it today. We all have patterns we repeat. Learn to recognize your patterns early. Maturation is really only learning to spot these patterns and having the self-discipline to make different decisions once you do. Practice will make the process faster. Life has shown me, again and again, that the answers to some of the most profound questions can only be revealed during the expedition. Those first, risky, wobbly steps will require some heart and your humility. We found our way to our town. The audience received us well, and I'd had a transformative experience along the way. I carry the lessons with me today. Representatives from Thornton Wilder's estate came to see the one-night-only benefit. One commented that it was one of the most poignant and moving versions she'd ever seen. Nicolette and I had just gotten married. This was the first piece I'd worked on since then, and I was able to connect emotional dots of love and loss in ways that I never knew were possible for me. There was a new emotional depth I'd found in my life that I was able to bring to my work. As for the translation of the text, we discovered that there were more than enough cognates in the universal language of the heart and the language of our shared humanity to bring a collective light of truth to our town. The new emotional depths and possibilities came as somewhat of a revelation to me, and I couldn't wait for the opportunity to test the limits once more. October was the subject line of an email that came from Lynn in the fall of 2013. Leslie, I hope this email finds you happy, healthy, and creative. So I'm writing Act Two of Hamilton as fast as I can. It's never fast enough for my tastes, but I digress. And we're hoping to sing through what I have so far on October 8th. I'd love to have you join us. We'd rehearse Saturday the 5th, take Sunday off, Monday the 7th, and the morning of Tuesday the 8th, and sing through it that afternoon. This is nothing so formal as the Vassar performance you saw. No audience, just us and Jeffrey Seller to see where we are. Are you around, available to play? Let me know. Siempre, Lin-Manuel. I didn't want 5 minutes to lapse without a response from me. I checked my calendar and hit reply, I'd love to. By the subject line, I got that I'd be reading the role of Aaron Burr. The schedule and material were in my inbox a few hours after that, and I got to work immediately. I figured I had an ace up my sleeve. There were just over 200 people who'd seen the first act of the Hamilton mixtape at Vassar. Coming into the week, I had an advantage in that I knew firsthand how incredibly special Lynn's piece was, and I knew how challenging it would be. Professionally, I've never been more game for anything in my life. Preparation is the sign of your intention. You can allow your preparedness to speak for you in rooms you care about. By October, Lynn had probably put in hundreds of hours of preparation and hard work. As I saw it, my impossible task was to try to catch up. There was no better way for me to show my affinity for the piece than to learn the words and rhythms exactly as the man had written them, and beyond that, try to begin to understand the reasons and impulses behind why he'd written them. This was a time to go for broke, and a time to find the courage to lay it all on the line. At Vassar, I thought that Hamilton was the smartest, freshest, most brilliant piece of original material I'd ever seen, and now it was in my hands. My personal goal for my very first week on the Hamilton mixtape was simple: to make them never want to see anyone else in the role of Burr ever again. We did several readings over the next year, each one more clearly in focus and more complete than the last. I watched the cast get assembled one by one. For me, there was never an actual audition to be in Hamilton after the email from Lynn. Instead, it was more like a protracted 2-year audition before the Broadway opening, which was only the beginning in many respects, but the surest end to the development process. For 2 years or so, I was focused on staying available and doing everything I could to knock it out of the park every time one of those presentations was scheduled. There were no assurances ever that you would make it to the next reading, let alone to the public theater or to Broadway. What you did know was how lucky you were to be invited into the process at such a delicate time, and how lucky you were that you might leave a lasting impression on the thing. We looked to our director, Tommy Cail, to our musical director and arranger, Alex Lacamoire, and to our choreographer, Andy Blankenbuehler, as lighthouses. Hamilton seemed to have a healing and disarming emotional power from the outset. During more than a year and a half of readings and rehearsals, I witnessed the reactions of hardened, jaded professionals from various facets of the entertainment business as they reconnected with childlike wonder and sometimes tears, as I had the first time I saw it. Love was my way into Lynn's work and to Aaron Burr. I didn't feel the need to approach Burr as a villain. That wasn't how Lynn approached him in the writing. Anyone who writes a character a song like Dear Theodosia or Wait For It is not looking at that character as a villain. Burr and Hamilton were close from the start. They had come up together, they respected each other, and different as they were in temperament, they had a lot in common. At 19 years old, neither would have believed they'd end up on those dueling grounds more than 25 years later. I wanted to be so led by love throughout the proceedings that I would be surprised by those final moments in the show. I wanted to be shocked by the ending every time. My goal, every time we arrived at the denouement, was to hope against hope that things could turn out differently. Kind of like the end of Romeo and Juliet. When you imagine there might be a last-minute twist to save the kids from themselves, you think, not this time, not tonight. My goal with Burr was to lead with his humanity. I would forego being liked by our audiences and settle instead for being understood. I wanted to make him as ugly and beautiful and flawed and interesting as the people in the seats who'd come to witness. In the process of developing the show, I was certain that something about the role and the experience was changing me from the inside. The work was making me a better friend, a better husband, a better man. I felt closer to God and closer to that bottomless creative well within all of us than I'd ever felt before. With Burr, I recognized that Lynn was giving me the opportunity to become the type of actor I always admired. There was nothing that could keep me from seeing this thing through to the finish. Nothing. Except a few months before we opened at the Public Theater off Broadway, that was exactly what a new series on NBC threatened to do. State of Affairs landed in my lap as one of the easiest jobs I'd ever gotten. I went in to read for the casting director on a Tuesday. She filmed the audition in her office. By the following Monday, I had the job. A pilot had never happened for me like that before, and it hasn't since. The whole process had been so painless, I could hardly believe they were serious when they called to offer me the job. I mean, you usually jump through hoop after hoop for these types of things. It takes weeks, months. You're usually trying to convince them that you're up to the task. This was almost too good to be true. I'd auditioned because, well, why not? The show would shoot in New York. My bank account had been giving me the side eye for months. My agents knew not to send me in for anything that would conflict with the Hamilton mixtape. I wouldn't even consider something that would put my participation in jeopardy. But I'll be honest, my commitment to the Hamilton mixtape in its development phase had financial ramifications. Doing some television uptown while I fed my artistic needs downtown made a lot of sense. Television is really nice work if you can get it. It isn't easy, but I wouldn't be the first actor in town who kept a role on television during the daytime and worked at night in the New York theater. For many, it's the only way the equation makes sense. Off-Broadway theater is a tricky financial proposition, no matter how brilliant the material. Television work can ease the hardship. If the pilot was picked up, as a series regular, I would supplement the $800 a week paycheck in Hamilton at the Public Theater, which gets cut nearly in half after taxes, commissions, and expenses, with my state of affairs payment of $35,000 an episode, which also looks a lot different after deductions. That was a model that made sense to me. The only problem was that state of affairs never intended to keep production in New York if it got picked up. The show would move to L.A., and as a contracted series regular, I would have to move to L.A. with it. I didn't know that piece of information until the announcement of the pickup happened. The role of a lifetime, in the most masterful piece of original work written for the theater that I'd ever encountered, was about to slip from my grasp on a technicality. For me, State of Affairs was a great job. Hamilton, an American musical, might have been one of the great loves of my life. Artistically, it was what I had been waiting for since my heart was first opened up, and I started down this path years ago. State of Affairs was a contract that would guarantee $500,000. At the time, the Hamilton agreement guaranteed less than $15,000. Financially, it wasn't even a contest. But Nicolette and I prayed, and I kept my focus on moving toward the thing that was making me feel most alive. Once I'd made the decision that Hamilton was what I wanted to do, advice poured in from respected advisors. Some suggested that I hire a lawyer to negotiate my way out of the state of affairs contract. Others recommended a PR maneuver or bringing more agents into the conversation. But the reality was that I had no legal recourse if NBC decided to enforce the terms of our agreement. After months of consideration, as elementary and ridiculous as it may sound, I realized that asking nicely was the only option I really had. I also had to admit to myself that if someone at NBC said no, for whatever reason, Hamilton would probably be over for me. Any misstep in my conversations with NBC could have serious career ramifications and risk burning bridges at one of the major TV networks. Not having the conversation would risk letting the role of a lifetime slip through my fingers without a fight. There is no risk that isn't tied to a consequence. You assess and make sure you can live with the ones you can foresee. In an email to Bob Greenblatt, the chairman of NBC Entertainment and someone who's turned out to be a real friend, I poured my heart out with as much honesty as seemed appropriate in the delicate situation. I wrote to Bob, "No one knows the power and relevance of a vital American theater more than you, Bob. I suspect that no one knows its pitfalls and challenges better than you do. You know what a rarity it is to come across a genuine masterpiece. If one is lucky, I mean truly, truly divinely blessed, at one point in your career, you are invited into the room at the development phase of an Angels in America, or a Sunday in the Park with George, or Rent. Think about the very first performers who were given the unsullied, never-before-seen-or-heard-of perfect librettos of Gypsy, or Fiddler on the Roof, or Dream Girls. They're part of history. Their contribution to the craft and to our industry was not only inspiring and entertaining, but extraordinarily necessary. Hamilton is that timeless and necessary work. This show is going to revolutionize our industry once again. I am desperate to be a part of it. I realized that this email bucks protocol. These are matters that are usually left to agents and managers, but I really wanted you to hear from me. It is out of respect for our friendship and the incredible amount of kindness you've shown me over the years that I wanted to try to explain what all the fuss is about and why this project means so much to me. Bob and the producers of the show let me out of my contract with no penalties. They wished me luck, and they meant it. When Hamilton tickets were most scarce a year and a half later, I found a way to repay them. In the end, I think that what made the connection to Lynn's work so deep for me was the language in which it was written. For one of the first times in my life as a professional actor, I felt like I was standing center stage in a work that was written in my tongue, even though the men and women that we were portraying were, in most instances, as disparate from us as could be imagined. The story was theirs at its inception, but this time around, the rhythms, the syncopations, the dance, the vibe, the pulse, the movement, the moment, this time around, was ours. This town was ours. No translation necessary. Chapter 8. Hamilton. Act 2. The New American Dream. But just for a moment, now we're all together. Just for a moment, we're happy. Let's look at one another. It goes so fast. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. Emily, in Thornton Wilder's Our Town. When we got word that the Broadway transfer of Hamilton wouldn't be happening until the following season, after our record-breaking run off-Broadway, I have to admit it was a tough pill to swallow. Lynn and the producers made the decision to give the show more time to cook off-Broadway. Rushing ran the risk, they felt, of key production elements not coming together quickly enough and endangering the quality of the show. That being said, Hamilton had amassed one of the strongest word-of-mouth campaigns the city had ever seen, and I wasn't alone in hoping a move uptown could come sooner rather than later. At that juncture for me, in early 2015, more time only meant more time struggling to make ends meet. We were in the middle of a bitter, lingering winter in New York City with winds, inclement weather, the works. I invested in a pair of long johns and a new sweatshirt. These would have to do, as there was no room in the budget that season for a new winter coat or boots for me or for Nicolette. Traveling by taxi was also a luxury we had to do without. The commute from our apartment in Hell's Kitchen to the public theater in the East Village could be brutal. Most of the cast was in a similar position. There were articles being written and lots of talk on the outside saying we were fools not to capitalize on the heat and buzz of the moment by transferring to Broadway as quickly as possible. Seemingly overnight, Hamilton had become the hottest ticket in New York City. The scarcity of tickets, due to the 300-seat capacity of our small off-Broadway home, fanned the flames of the frenzy. There were those who warned that if we thought the same attention would be waiting for us whenever we decided to move uptown the following season, we were deluded. We paid our dues that winter. The off-Broadway run wasn't easy for any of us, but it sure did serve to bring us closer together. Over the developmental process, I had the unique pleasure of watching a cast of supernovas assemble one by one. The small ensemble at the Vassar Reading was made up of almost entirely different players than our cast at the Public Theater. Lynn, David Diggs, and Chris Jackson were the only cast members who remained from the Hamilton mixtape reading that I saw in the small theater in Poughkeepsie. I was added next in the Oktoberfest. The developmental reading after that saw the arrival of Philippa Sue in an expertly sung, brilliantly restrained and miraculous performance as Eliza Hamilton. The workshop after that brought us Oak, Akiriete Onaudewon, in the roles of Hercules Mulligan and James Madison, Anthony Ramos in the dual roles of John Lawrence and Philip Hamilton, and Renee Elise Goldsberry in her star turn as Angelica Schuyler. They were each so distinct and skillful. It was clear when a new member was added to the crew permanently. The keepers were always easy to spot. It wasn't just talent that would get your foot in the door and keep it there. Your humanity played a part. It was generosity and kindness. It was intelligence and fearlessness. Lynn and Tommy were recruiting a championship team. Jasmine Cephas Jones played Peggy Schuyler and Mariah Reynolds, and she was added before we started rehearsals at the Public. Another winner. Jasmine is stunning, with a confidence that belied her youth. Together, along with an ensemble of 14 other triple threats, we did close to 150 performances of Hamilton off-Broadway. What they were unable to give us in money at the Public Theater, they gave us in artistic resources, warmth, and kindness. It was a glorious space for creating new work, and they supported us as a company and as individuals in every way they could think of. Oscar Eustace, who runs the Public Theater, leads with unmatched passion and ferocity. I've never met an enemy of his. Eustace is one of the beloved. I'm not sure if anyone outside of the creative team has seen Hamilton more times than Oscar and his brilliant wife, Lori. Through development and our off-Broadway run, they were in the audience many, many times, and I always found their presence comforting and focusing. Oscar would find me backstage afterward at some point with tears still in his soulful eyes. The refrain was always the same. You know it's never like this, Leslie. You have to know that it's never like this. I know it, Oscar. This is special, comrade. I know, Oscar. And I really did. When we closed the show at the Public, 5 months after we opened, it was a joyful time. Spring had returned to New York City. There was expectation in the air. We had 6 weeks off and a Broadway theater waiting for us. Don't ever stop getting better. Make it your mantra. Make it habitual. Coming into rehearsals for the Broadway run, I think we all felt the strong desire to level up. There was no reason to deny that we'd made something special downtown and that it had found an audience. It was connecting with people viscerally and gaining influential new fans in almost every theater-loving group. But no one in the company of Hamilton had any desire to stop growing and learning in the interim between productions. The scheduled Broadway opening night fell on my birthday, August the 6th, which, after the road I'd been on to make it to that very night, somehow felt like a cosmic wink, a sign that everything was gonna be all right, maybe more than all right. There were absolutely no guarantees at any point during the development process. There was no promise of a Broadway run when I answered Lynn's October invitation. There was no guarantee that I'd be kept in the role of Burr even after I walked away from the television series for the production at the Public Theater. We had indications that the show was impactful and that it could find its audience if given the opportunity, but the worldwide embrace of the material after the Broadway bow was not something that any of us could have predicted. We kept our heads down and in the work. For my part, before rehearsals began for Broadway, I took on the dreaded but necessary task of watching and critiquing my work. There was a digital copy of the off-Broadway show that was floating around. It was a tool used solely for the purposes of bringing understudies up to the task of stepping in for performers at a moment's notice in case of illness or emergency. It was also a great visual reference to improve on Andy Blank.